Hey, I'm Eric Torenberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Brad Hargraves. Brad is the founder of General Assembly and Now Common, which aims to do to co-living what WeWork has done for co-working. In this episode, we talk about Brad's come-up story, lessons learned while running General Assembly, what the real estate industry is like, especially as it applies to tech, why he prefers being an operator to an investor, and much more. All right, here's Brad. We're going to get deep into the Common story, but first I want to start even way back. You know, before Common, you founded General Assembly with your buddies, and before that, you know, you're doing a bunch of experiments in Yale.
I had no idea what I wanted to do in college. I just kind of fell into it and fell in love with it. So when I was in college, I started selling antique furniture online, buying it off of primarily colleges and universities, refurbishing it, and then selling it on eBay. And we had our own e-commerce site, and it was fun. Yeah.
Did you like furniture, or were you just?
Well, I loved history. I've always been a big fan of history, and there were these awesome pieces of history that were really coming out of, you know, interesting universities that were just throwing it all away or, you know, getting rid of it somehow. And so we built some relationships and started getting this furniture, and we're like, wow, what do we do with it? So started listing it online, and that was my first experience as an entrepreneur. And it was, skipping college to rent a U-Haul and go pick up furniture from some random university. It was a lot of fun.
Did you take a semester off?
Never took a semester off, no. Actually, just went straight through. Skipped a lot of class, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I did, too.
The way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you, and did you work with any of your General Assembly?
Yeah, actually, Matt Breimer and I, is one of my co-founders at General Assembly, and also worked with me. He was my co-founder of that. I mean, if you can even call us co-founders, given that we were mostly just buying and selling furniture. We worked on that together, and it was a ton of fun.
So let's start from the beginning. How did the General Assembly story come?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, we initially started General Assembly kind of as this community hub. This was kind of before co-working was really an established thing, and certainly before WeWork turned it into a business. We wanted to create this community hub for entrepreneurs, designers, hackers, etc. And so we built out this beautiful space back in 2010 in New York City. And we just started getting a lot of people coming by, hanging out. We would have people teach classes and open them to the community. And pretty quickly, we started noticing that there was more of a demand for these classes than there was for the space. And, you know, the space we sold out, and that was it. And there was really nowhere we wanted to go from there because we didn't exactly want to build another space. So we just kept doing more classes, more classes, more classes. And that kind of got us on this idea that there's a big gap between what's taught in universities and the skills people need to succeed in the workforce. So everything from, you know, keep in mind, this was in 2010, you know, digital marketing, UX design, web development, product management, data science. These were all things that companies really needed, both startups and kind of large Fortune 500s. They needed these skill sets, and there was really no one training people in these disciplines. So we took time to actually start building longer courses, like 3-month immersives, full-time programs, part-time programs, that gave people some of these skills and were tied into job opportunities in these companies. And that, you know, that took off, and, we found ourselves out of the space business and into the education business pretty quickly.
At what point did you make the pivot from the co-working space to the education? That was a huge pivot, but, you know, change of focus.
It was so gradual. I mean, it just kind of happened. It's like one day we were running a co-working space that offered classes, and the next moment we were running a school that offered co-working. So there was never a moment where we all kind of, at least I don't remember it, where we all kind of sat down and were like, you know what? We're going to build an education company. No, it just, you know, we looked up one day and we had an education company.
Right. And I know you and Breimer well, you have such different skill sets.
It's a wonderful thing. It really is. I, you know, I have so much respect for both the role he played at building General Assembly. He's one of my best friends, and also now onto Daybreaker and what he's doing there, which just seems like such a crazy idea in the abstract. But if there's anyone who can pull off bringing an early morning dance party to a dozen cities or whatever they're in now, it's Matt Breimer.
Yeah, no, I love Daybreaker. How would you describe your core competency?
It's really kind of the intersection of product and marketing is kind of where I've always focused. So, I built the education business at General Assembly and then ran product there for a few years. So, really coming up with new markets and kind of the intersection of, where's their demand, where's their interest, and, where can we build something that really is compelling and meets a user need. I've always been, as a hobby, building games. I've been building games since I was in the seventh grade, but I never really looked at that as a potential job. So I've come from a little bit of some tech in my background, but I've never looked at that really as kind of my core competency.
Are you a huge gamer still?
To the extent I have time for it, yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. And how would you describe Breimer's?
Oh my God, making magical things happen. That's pretty much it. I guess I was always like much more of like, the operator, reasonable one. And, he was the one that would come up with crazy ideas and get them done. And, that's how, big chunk of this got built. And, Jake as well, who is CEO of General Assembly to this day, brings a lot of experience to the table too. So we had a great group of folks in the early days of General Assembly.
And when you kind of advise other entrepreneurs, how do you advise them to kind of build out their co-founder teams? Like what skill sets are absolutely necessary? Or
I go back to the idea that you need someone who can sell and someone who can build. And sometimes that comes in one package and sometimes it doesn't. But in an early stage company, generally you're either selling or you're building. And both those are skill sets in and of themselves, and they require as much, knowing how to sell. And by sell, I don't necessarily mean like sell a product for money. I mean, come up with a compelling vision, come up with a value proposition, understand how to marry a product and a market. That's a skill set that is honed over time just as much as, software development is.
No, definitely. And as you spent, almost 5 years at General Assembly, how did you think about what you might want to do next?
Well, one, I kind of got enamored with this need, this customer need that, there was, there's a massive housing shortage in major cities. People in particular, young people in particular, many of General Assembly students were moving to major cities and would struggle to find places to live. And that kind of cued me into this concept of, rental real estate is a rough user experience between dealing with brokers, dealing with landlords and their giant reams of paper, showing up to a tour and bringing a cashier's check and having to close that day. There's just a lot of rough parts of the user experience, and looked at this and said, is there a way, both kind of from a financial standpoint as well as from a, user-centered design standpoint, that you can build a better experience? So improve on the real estate, improve on the UX, improve on the kind of brand and the design. And, frankly, you've got a lot of young people, living in major cities with roommates. It's something that happens all the time. But there's no real estate. There's no housing that's designed for the needs of roommates. You have people effectively living in units and in houses that are designed for families, because that's how we've been building housing for a long time, designed for families, with, 4, 5, 6 roommates. And we looked at this and said, there's an opportunity to build something that's, kind of more designed, both from a kind of sticks and bricks real estate perspective, as well as, from a product perspective, more designed for the needs of roommates.
And what have been the traditional barriers preventing others from doing this in the past?
Yeah, well, it's, one is it's incredibly tricky to actually get inventory. That's the real bottleneck here, is how do you get whole buildings You know, because I really think whole buildings work the best for this. If you can take a vacant building and, you know, kind of build a community within it, you know, as opposed to taking single rooms or single units off the market. So we really built this competency around real estate and finance and how do you structure these deals in a way that kind of incentivizes everyone to do the right thing, do the best possible thing for the user. So, you know, we're kind of set up a little bit like a management company. You know, the best way to think about what Common is it's like, you know, Starwood for residential buildings. And we thought that, you know, in hospitality, you have a lot of great brands that have built incredible user experiences. You don't have that in residential real estate. So we're looking to kind of take a model that's been perfected in the hotel space and take it into an area where you have kind of longer term tenants, longer term residents.
Are you guys competitors to the hospitality industry at all?
We're really not. You know, we don't look at ourselves as a competitor to like a hotel or an Airbnb at all because, you know, we're not serving tourists. These are not people who are here, or in New York temporarily. Our minimum stay is 30 days. So, you know, we really look at ourselves more as, and our target audience really are people who are staying here a lot longer. You know, we want to build a community. We want to cultivate a group of people that are here for a long time and not just transients coming in and out. So we don't really look at ourselves as competitive with any kind of traditional hotel.
How do you compete with WeWork when, you know, they think about their WeLive thing and they already have, you know, so much real estate already?
Well, a bunch of ways. One is, you know, it's a super fragmented market. You're talking about, multifamily residential real estate. You know, new buildings open up all the time. So there's no dominant player. There's not even any player that owns more than like 0.1% of the market in residential real estate. So it's not like thinking about a SaaS application or something like that where, or a social network where it's a winner take all. It's, you know, we're thinking about it much more in terms of how do we deliver a great user experience. You know, there's such a housing shortage in these cities. You know, I think we will all be lucky as a society and a culture if there's so much competition bringing so much new housing onto the market that it actually meaningfully lowers rents. Like, yeah, it may not be good for us as a business, but think about how transformative that would actually be to society if so many competitors with new housing models came onto the market that you actually lowered the cost of renting an apartment. Like, that would be completely revolutionary and transformative. So, you know, I look at it as a win-win.
What have you learned about starting a company and building your early team, you know, from General Assembly that you've taken almost 5 years later?
Yeah, totally. So I try to, you know, it's one of the things I think we did tremendously well at General Assembly that, you know, we're replicating here at Common. We have, you know, we have a small team. We have 13 people now. We have a mix of people on the real estate side and the finance side, you know, community, product and engineering and design. And, you know, we really look at this at an early stage as, you know, you hire for people, not for roles. And you hire for skill sets as well, not for roles. So, you know, when you're a 200-person company, I mean, General Assembly by the time I left was, you know, 600-odd employees, you know, you really hire for roles. You kind of have to hire for roles. You write a job description. This is exactly what we want. This is what the job is responsible for. This is what it fits into. With an early stage company like Common, I would say kind of anything pre-25 people, it's really hard to hire for specific roles, and you kind of end up hiring for hats. And you can end up with one person. You almost have to end up with one person that wears multiple hats. And you can kind of think about it dynamically and say, hey, we have four hats that need to be worn. We want someone who's probably going to wear two or three of those hats. And think about like what kind of combinations of hats you can put together. So when we put job descriptions up, which we do, you know, we almost think about them less as like, oh, here's a very specific, narrowly defined role we're hiring for, and more just like honeypots of like, hey, let's put this out here. Let's get applications. Let's get smart people in the door that we can start having conversations with. And then, you know, we can figure out what hats would be best for them to wear. And, you know, what hats would be best for them to wear today. And then what hats would be best for them to wear when we're a 50, 60, 70 person company. That is, how are they going to grow with the organization?
And you guys raised a bunch of money. I'm not sure if you talk about it.
Yeah, we, We raised $7.5 million basically from a PowerPoint, you know, led by Maveron, which is a great firm started by Dan Levitan and Howard Schultz of Starbucks fame. It's a great group of people. They're the lead investors in General Assembly as well. So I've built a relationship with them over 5 years. So they're the kind of people I want on my board. You know, we have Jason Stouffer, who's a partner at Maveron, on our board. And it was so easy. I didn't shop it at all. It was really like I was leaving General Assembly, had been talking back and forth with the Maveron folks about what I might want to do next. And, you know, kind of as soon as I honed in on this and said, hey, I'd like to take a, you know, like to try building a better user experience here and building a business in this space. They said, hey, why don't we do it together? So, you know, raised $7.5 million pretty much on day one.
And you had a, you know, you have other strategics involved. And you had a lot of people who wanted to get in. How do you think about evaluating, you know, which investors are going to be most helpful to you and in what context?
Yeah, so it's, you know, we were in the fortunate place so that we had a lot more interest in the round than, you know, than we had space. You know, Maveron did about 70% of the round and we had about $2 million left over to, you know, allocate to interesting strategics, angels. You know, one thing I certainly wanted to do is, you know, make sure people who have been helpful to me in the past were able to get in. So that was kind of first priority. And then find some really interesting strategics in the real estate space. So, you know, my background's not in real estate. My background's in, you know, as I said, kind of technology and product. So getting people who really understood real estate and understood how real estate deals got done, how capital was raised in real estate were really important, really, really important to get into the round. Because after all, it's like, you know, we not only had to raise money for the operating company, the venture-backed company, but, you know, we basically buy buildings, so we have to raise a separate pool of real estate capital, you know, so we can actually control the real estate assets and you know, have the kind of control that we want over the properties.
Real estate is interesting because a lot of people say that WeWork is very overvalued because WeWork is valuing itself as a tech company instead of a real estate company, but they see it as a real estate company. You know, what is kind of the intersection of a real estate company and a tech company?
Yeah, totally. So I can't speak for WeWork or speak to their valuation because, you know, I'm neither WeWork nor am I an investor. But, you know, I think the value proposition is that how people work is changing, how people live is changing. There will be companies, large companies, maybe not $18 billion companies, but very large companies created around the future of work and living. And, you know, WeWork is, you know, I think very smartly positioning itself as one of the companies that, you know, will really be providing these kind of new work and living relationships and these new kind of, you know, both on the, you know, co-working side as well as, you know, now the co-living side. And I think people look at us in, you know, focused on living and focused on the challenges of living and not kind of split between work and residential. People kind of look at us as taking advantage of, you know, those kind of secular macro changes as well.
And how do you, who spent, you know, your time post-college in a tech company, but how do you become an expert on real estate?
Oh my God, that is a tough one. Real estate is so different. Like the way real estate people think about business is so different than the way someone from a venture-backed operating company thinks about business. And just how do you think about creating value? How do you think about, and once you understand that, and frankly, the only way I understood it is to dive in and frankly, surround myself with some great people who have been doing it their entire lives and then try to, you know, make, you know, bring the models together and kind of understand how they can mesh in some really interesting ways. So you start realizing why it is the way it is. Why do landlords act the way they act? Why do property management companies act the way they act? And, you know, one of the biggest understandings that I never had before that I do now, that, you know, if any real estate people are listening in are like, well, duh, is so much of it is dependent on the time horizon of your investors. And if you are, everyone thinks about real estate as being a very long-term game because we're familiar with like multi-generational property ownership, like, oh, I'm going to buy this building and in 30 years the mortgage will be paid off and my kids will inherit it. You know, that actually is a relatively small percentage of how deals get done. The vast majority of deals are done by property developers that think in very, very short-term increments, even shorter than you see with technology venture-backed businesses. They're thinking in terms of 18 to 36 months, you know, get a construction loan, buy a plot of land, build something, fill it up, refinance, that is, get takeout financing that cashes out their construction loan and their equity. They own the building for free, and then they just move on to the next one. So it's a very, very, and once they move on to the next one, you know, they're not really any more involved than a founder after they've sold their company and left the acquirer. So it's why you don't really see many buildings that have incredibly active community management, programming, you know, the kind of community that you would expect to see from like a General Assembly. You don't really see that in most, you know, kind of residential or commercial properties. And it really goes back to how are these companies structured?
So I know nothing about real estate. So this is, you know, talking to you.
Sorry if I get too deep in the weeds. Just call me out of them.
Please do. This is how we learn. Did the real estate world embrace, you know, or investors, did they embrace Common right away to say, oh, this is obvious, this is totally going to happen?
You know, it runs as far across the spectrum as you can imagine. I mean, you know, we had some people who fell in love with us from day one. And fortunately, the great thing about this is you don't need everyone to fall in love with you. You just need a few people to get the kind of inventory you need to really start proving out the experience and the product. So, yeah, fortunately, we had some great people who fell in love with us from day one. But yeah, I mean, we were sitting in plenty of meetings where people like just kind of stared at us. And, you know, interestingly enough, they'll usually treat you better. You know, you hear all these terrible things about VCs being like, or, you know, real estate folks being like sharp elbowed and, you know, slimy. You know, frankly, like most real estate investors, I remember them treating us better here than, you know, I was treated when I was a entrepreneur with no background trying to pitch VCs. And, you know, I can't remember a single real estate investor who was on their phone the whole time or fell asleep in the meeting. And definitely had some VCs do that. You know,
fell asleep in the meeting.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like I can count three separate times. You know, when I was 6 years ago raising money, you know, for some idea, like VCs would literally fall asleep in the room. And maybe I'm just not exciting enough. But it's you know, did not have that happen with any real estate investors, fortunately.
Let's hypothetically, let's just say I am a very successful venture capitalist and or a founder with a big successful exit, and hopefully not too hypothetically in the future. And, you know, let's say I want to get into real estate and I have success in tech. Is real estate, you know, advise me, is real estate like tech a very relationships driven business? And would my relationship slash experience as a successful VC and or founder translate?
Depends and no, respectively. So it really, I mean, real estate can be an exceptionally relationships-driven business if that's the strategy you're playing. Like if you're trying to get like interesting off-market deals, like do weird stuff, like, yeah, it's a totally relationships-driven business. Or if you just want like a solid, you know, 6%, 7% year-over-year return, it doesn't have to be a very relationships-driven business. It's super straightforward. It's very, very low risk. So that said, I think a lot of like, I just see a lot of tech people and founders getting into real estate and now just seeing what I know from like experiencing it firsthand. I think they often try to get too creative, and like getting super creative in real estate is often how you lose your shirt. So, and you know, I say this completely hypocritically, you know, but I don't know. I generally think real estate works well for people without real estate experience when they take a very, you know, very low risk approach to it. But you know, I'm, you know, not following my own advice.
What's an example of a weird off-market thing, you know, besides something what you're doing, that you've seen people do that hasn't worked or you're not sure?
You get pitched all kinds of strange stuff all the time when you're in real estate. It's like, you know, especially when you're trying to do something interesting in the real estate world, it's like, oh, New York City has this canal, the Gowanus Canal, that's like a Superfund site, meaning it's like contaminated with all sorts of like heavy metals and like really, really stuff you don't want to mess with. And, you hear someone coming to you all the time being like, oh, I've got this site like right on the Gowanus Canal. Like, you know, it used to be industrial. We're converting it to residential. And like, you know, hopefully they don't find like, you know, arsenic in the groundwater or something. So it's like, yeah, you see all kinds of weird stuff. And frankly, I ignore most of it. And rather than innovating on kind of where the place is located, innovate on the community, innovate on the on the look and feel of the place, innovate on the amenities in the building, innovate on the technology that goes around it. I mean, we put a lot of technology into these homes, and that's a big part of the value prop. So rather than like doing some kooky thing with where it's located, I'd just rather kind of innovate on the end user experience.
So I'm in, you know, San Francisco, you're in New York, and, you know, also San Francisco and Brooklyn and New York also have a lot of gentrification is a popular topic.
Yeah.
How do you guys think about it?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, we set out some simple rules at the very beginning that we follow, you know, to really stay on the right side of it. One of those rules is we only go into vacant buildings. We're not going in. There are a lot of real estate developers that make money by kind of kicking out existing tenants and replacing them with new tenants. We don't touch any of that. So basically it either has to be kind of a vacant, dilapidated building or a new building that just came online. And those are kind of the two things we look at. So, you know, making sure we're not actively contributing to displacement. Two is working with a lot of local businesses. So a lot of our efforts on the community thus far have been about building relationships with local businesses. So making sure, because I think one of the challenges and one of the issues with bringing a different audience into an existing neighborhood is that chains end up following and you lose a lot of the magic that makes the neighborhood special. So a lot of what we're trying to do is build those relationships with existing businesses, get our members to actively engage with those businesses as opposed to like, you know, making sure the, you know, getting the big chain into the neighborhood or something like that. So, you know, there's a couple of things we're doing. You know, now that kind of our first two buildings are up and running, we're going to spend a lot more time kind of engaging the existing community organizations in the neighborhoods, which we haven't had as much time to do over the past 2 months since we've been launching. But yeah, starting to get our footprint out there a little bit more.
How do you think about expansion?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, expansion is a key part of Commons, both mission and value proposition, because I think there's an opportunity to create this global community of individuals all kind of living in common. And one of the value propositions that we have is that you can transition seamlessly between common buildings. So you can actually, with 24 hours notice, move from a empty room in one common, or move from a room in one common building to an empty room in another common building anywhere. So in another city, in another neighborhood, within the same city. And that's really powerful. And that's very different than what anyone has done in residential real estate before. And in order to deliver on that, we really have to be in a number of major cities. And I kind of look at you know, you can kind of look at the General Assembly expansion playbook going into cities where you have, you know, a lot of, you know, creative individuals moving there and say, you know, those are the cities we need to be in. So SF, LA, DC, Seattle, Boston, places like that. Yeah, and I think we'd be remiss to not include a really cool vacation spot or two in the common network. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about it. But it, you know, fortunately, we now have, you know, 30 members living in common buildings, and, you know, you can just ask them, like, where else would they like to see common? And asking your users is a wonderful thing.
What pieces do you need to have in place before you expand?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the most important thing is getting the, you know, real estate, you know, being able to access interesting buildings and interesting inventory. So, you know, we're already putting kind of acquisitions people down in a few cities where we want to start kind of getting a sense of the inventory on the market and exploring, you know, does it make sense for us to take a vacant building in one of those cities? You know, we've got a number of people on the ground, you know, in other cities. And really, once we kind of have a timeline in a city, then adding, you know, someone to start building community. We work with a lot of wonderful partners in New York, including General Assembly, to help them find a home for their students and other groups to help them find a home for their audiences. So I think continuing to work with other groups like that and other cities we go into.
I want to ask you some broader questions about being an entrepreneur. First, if you weren't doing Common and you had to do another idea, what's something that comes to mind? Or
oh my God, so one idea that I'm just going to throw one out. I mean, there's one idea that someone needs to do, and I would love to advise on this or whatever if someone's doing it, is to basically, you see all these entrepreneurs out there who are trying to find operators to, run their businesses. They're not like, how are they finding all these operators? It's like you see a lot of entrepreneurs who go on and say, I'm creating an incubator for my ideas and going to hire teams around them. And I wonder where all these operators are coming from. So I think, GA does, kind of long since got away from the idea of training entrepreneurs and kind of training people to be like founder CEOs as opposed to tech hires and design hires. Totally think there's an opportunity to create a, probably free school for operators, like people who don't necessarily have their own idea but want to found a business, and then pair them up with chairman CEO or kind of executive chair types. So I was playing around with doing something like that. Ultimately, kind of felt that the real estate model was the better, kind of the more impactful one, and the one that would be just a kind of bigger one to sink my teeth into. So yeah.
Yeah, I remember you think education is going to be huge.
Yeah, I also was really interested in preschool. I think a lot of the innovation, just coming out of General Assembly, I mean, GA has done an amazing job, innovating on postgraduate education. So everything kind of after college, effectively building a new type of graduate school. Education is a huge industry. It's extraordinarily complicated. The vast majority of the money is kind of controlled by school districts and large institutions. So it's actually really, really difficult to build a business, with the exception of kind of what I like to refer to as like the handlebars, pre-K and post-grad. And you look at kind of major cities in the US, huge lack of pre-K, daycare, whatever you want to call it. It's a real challenge. And, I looked at that, did kind of a deep dive into that. Once again, ultimately, I decided to go in a different direction, but that's another business absolutely someone should build.
What do you think are the real challenges of that business? Like, why isn't it happening? Why isn't someone built to
massive regulatory challenges? You have to have, a Travis Kalanick level of dedication to, completely doing an end around to a crazy set of regulations if you want to do that, because otherwise I don't think there's a way to actually make it work, but I could be wrong. Someone's got to do it.
Yeah. What has been one of your most humbling experiences as an entrepreneur? Does experience come top of mind?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this came shortly after I graduated from school. I was I'd built a small game development studio, and we had built some really popular games. Everything was team and rivalry based. It was called Go Cross Campus. We never figured out how to make money from it, which was kind of okay in 2006 and 2007, and was very much not okay in 2008 and 2009, given the lack of we did a lot of sponsorships and stuff like that, and we, ad dollars were, a lot easier to come by in 2006 and 2007, as were venture dollars. And in 2009, we had to shut down the studio, and that was an incredibly humbling and sad moment. And it certainly makes me a lot more thoughtful about building a business today, especially aware, being aware that we're in an environment with pretty cheap capital right now and venture dollars that are relatively easy to get, kind of knowing that that's not always going to be the case, that there will be lean times too. And, a business should be built to withstand those lean times. Otherwise, you have to do some really painful things like laying people off. And that's something I hope to never have to do again.
Do you have any rituals or, habits you swear by either as a CEO or personal productivity?
Oh, so all right. So this is going to kind of not be an answer to either of those, but the thing I swear by is, and I,
Chica.
I got married. I got married, end of 2014. And my wife's an entrepreneur as well. She runs a company called Stacklist, which helps entrepreneurs choose tools and services, which was actually like one of the top Product Hunt products in September, which I'm super excited for. So we do quarterly planning as a couple. That is, we actually sit, and it's on the top of my mind because we did our Q1 planning in just this past weekend. And, you know, we sit down, we go through a financial overview, we go through kind of an operational and household overview, we go through a social overview, and it takes like 2 hours, but we hit all the major points. You know, we come up with like what we're going to do, what we're going to change, how do we make our relationship better? And, you know, it's a dedicated time for that. And why that's great is it takes all of those like annoying things that you've been meaning to discuss, but like haven't really found the right opportunity to do that, or like don't want it, you know, stuff you don't want to have come up on like date night. And you kind of put it in a dedicated spot, and it's been actually like a wonderful thing. And I swear by quarterly planning and personal OKRs. That's the other one.
All right, tell me more.
Oh, and so OKRs are objectives and key results. It's kind of a, you know, goal setting system, developed by Google and Intel. A lot of companies use them. The idea is like high level qualitative objective, you know, and then a few key results under each objective, which is like, how is the objective going to be measured? You know, we do them at Common. So every single person has OKRs. We do them quarterly, and I do them personally as well.
What are some examples?
Oh, so one of my objectives from last quarter was be healthier than I've ever been. And, you know, that's a great high-level objective. It's kind of able to get me motivated and excited to do it. And then you put some, you know, you put some KRs under that. So how's that going to be measured? Well, that can be measured by, you know, my weight. It could be measured by how many times I go to the gym. It could be measured by what's my, you know, 5K time. So come up with a couple of ways that are like, well, how do I measure that? And then the idea with OKRs is you set them aggressively, and if you hit 20% of them, or sorry, if you hit 60% of them, you're doing well.
Take me through the quarterly planning. It's a couple. I'm fascinated by this concept.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we should probably open source our template. It's pretty simple. It's just like running through all the basic things. There's like, you know, we start with a financial overview because it's the hardest. You know, we look at kind of, you know, how much did we burn last quarter? You know, assuming we're burning. I mean, you know, we're entrepreneurs, so we generally burn money. So how much you burn last quarter, you know, go through all the key metrics. How much did we spend on what? You know, what's our, you know, if you want to do budgeting, you can do budgeting. I kind of go back and forth on whether budgeting makes sense. So yeah, just go through all that and then talk about, you know, operations, talk about household. The idea is to kind of go through, and there's no, I wouldn't say there's a one size fits all way to do this. I mean, it probably depends on, it depends on the couple. It depends on what, you know, what kind of relationship people want. How close do they want to be? How much do they want to share? I think it's awesome though.
What's something you use to fervently believe, whether it's about running a company or just business or personal life or intellectually, that you now see as misguided?
Oh man, I'll have to think on that one for a second. You know, I would say just like one thing, one area I've evolved in and changed is I feel like I've become a lot calmer over like the last 5 years, you know, going through the craziness of building General Assembly, now kind of onto it again. You know, my, you know, something I tell myself probably on a more than weekly basis and tell my team almost every day is it's never as good as it seems, nor is it as bad. Mm-hmm. And just like being able to keep that in mind and just keep a little more even keeled, I think has been a real way I've evolved. And I feel like I used to believe that successful businesses were built on the back of insane work hours and panic. And that's I no longer believe that.
If there was another world in which you were talking to someone who had your same exact experience after General Assembly, imagine a clone of Brad, and that Brad was thinking to be a full-time venture capitalist, would you tell that Brad, yeah, sure, if that's what you want to do, go for it? Or would you tell that Brad, no, you should be running a company because running a company is where the opportunity is, and because you could be an even more powerful investor after that?
Oh my God. You know, that Brad would have to have so much more patience than this Brad has. You know, here's the problem with, you know, after being an operator for 8 years, you know, I spent a little bit of time as a venture partner, kind of an EIR at Maveron, and I feel like I was terrible at it. And I would always see the companies, whenever I was pitched, I would always see the companies that I would build if I were in the entrepreneur's shoes, and I wouldn't pay attention to the business the entrepreneur is actually building. And, you know, I step back and I was like, wow, if I were an entrepreneur, I would hate Brad as a VC, because I just, like, I want to get in the weeds. Like, I can't help it. I do. I care about that. And not in, like, a helpful, I can empathize as a VC, formerly entrepreneur way. No, I want to get involved in a really annoying, dictatorial sort of way. I mean, obviously, that's a little bit of a exaggeration, but, like, I just looked at it and said, there's no way I can do this. Like, I want to operate, you know, I love building businesses, and I do not have the patience to, you know, and I have a huge amount of admiration for people who have the patience to kind of bet on horses, bet on entrepreneurs and support them through thick and thin and not feel the need to kind of dive in and do it themselves. But I'm not one of those people.
When you look at Bezos and some of the other CEOs and operators you really admire, what's something that they do that you do or you're trying to do that other CEOs just don't do?
Yeah, it's I think great. You know, if you look at great executives of larger companies, I've done the entrepreneurship thing successfully. They try to get really diverse sets of people around them, people who don't always necessarily share their opinions, who don't always agree with everything they say. And I feel like that's one of the things I've really tried intentionally to do at Common is not to create have a monoculture, but to get a really interesting set of people together who come from diverse perspectives and can kind of lend their experience to what we do. So for instance, our CFO, who is one of our first employees here at Common, he came out of retirement to join our company as CFO. He formerly ran capital markets in Asia at Goldman Sachs and was on the board of a bank. And that's normally not someone I would kind of run into on a regular basis.
How'd you recruit him?
Just actually, interestingly, and this is never something I would advocate, it just happened to work. It just happens to work in this situation. I recruited both him and his son at the same time. They were entrepreneurs working on a concept together themselves as kind of a CEO-chairman combination, and they just decided to join Common as employees number one and two. And I would I feel like I had to spend so much time like understanding the relationship and making sure it worked because it's so non-traditional and so weird, but it works. It works beautifully.
What's that like?
It's a terrible idea. Generally, it just happens to work in this one particular situation because of their relationship, because they've worked together in the past, because they take a very professional approach to it. And I kind of spent a lot of time vetting that, and it just kind of works. And I don't think there's no checklist I would put together of like, oh, if you're thinking about hiring a father-son team as employees number one and two of your startup, here's what I would do. No, don't do it. It's a terrible idea. But in this case, it just happens to work. I don't know. I would not advise anyone to do it, though.
Do you advise the same thing when you talk to couples who want to start a company together?
I think that I also think that's a terrible idea. You're just layering risk on top of risk. I mean, it's like there's a chance. I mean, at least with a father-son team, it's not like they're going to break up.
Right.
They're still going to be father and son. So with couples, though, I mean, let's say there's an X percent probability your company blows up and there's a Y percent probability your relationship blows up. Obviously, if your company blows up, you don't want your relationship to also blow up. That would be really bad, and vice versa. So, but it feels like you're kind of layering risk on top of risk there. I don't know. I mean, I've seen people do it successfully. I feel like I've heard of people doing it successfully. I feel like I've heard of people, hiding that type of thing from investors for a long time, which, may or may not be the right idea. But once again, like hiring a father-son team, starting something with your significant other, it's like there are some things that like I have done that just happened to either work or be working that I would just generally not recommend as a rule.
Do you, if you were 18 today, knowing what you know now, would you go to Yale? Do you advise other people who are ahead of the curve to go?
Oh man. I mean, I was so fortunate to be able to do that. I met a lot of amazing people. I met Matt there. I started my first two companies there. You know, I've been extraordinarily fortunate as a person to be able to, you know, I grew up in the rural South, you know, to be able to do the things I've done that, you know, there's no way I can look back on it and say, I wouldn't have done that. Like, you know, who knows what that would have changed? Like, who knows how else my life would have turned out? Like, I have no idea. So there's no way I can, in good faith, look at it and say, I would have done something different, or to look someone in the eye and say, like, you know, don't go to college. I found it to be a wonderful experience. You know, that said, I've spent the last 5-6 years building a company that teaches skills outside of a college context. And I am an advocate of gap years and taking a gap year. You know, I'm a personal investor in Dale Stevens, you know, company UnCollege, you know, based on advocating the idea of taking a gap year. You know, I love what Dale is building there, kind of creating a path for students who, you know, for young people, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds who may not be ready for college. You know, I'm a big fan of college and that experience, but sometimes I think people would, you know, get more out of it if they had a little bit more context. I think I probably would have gotten more out of it if I had a little bit more more context around, like, what's the real world like. So I am an advocate for taking a year off.
Did you first get exposed to entrepreneurship in college?
Yes, I did. No, it was not really a thing where I'm from.
And what did your parents think of what you're doing with General Assembly?
That's a good question. It's funny. I you know, obviously they're extraordinarily proud of me and excited for me. I'm not, you know, I love them. They're responsible for who I am today in large part. But it's funny because they still kind of think about it in a kind of large company make the boss happy context. So the question they always ask me is, like, not is the company doing well? It's like, are your investors happy? So that's always the question, is are your investors happy?
Did you think about moving to San Francisco at one point?
You know, I just kind of ended up through circumstance in New York while I was working on my game development studio, because we had some employees who were here, and I fell in love with it. I love this city. It's a wonderful place. I mean, you know, maybe it's a little hard to say that today when it's 20 degrees outside, but, you know, it's, I love the city. My wife and I live in, you know, here in Chelsea now. I enjoy visiting San Francisco, but one of the things I just love about New York is, you know, you go to a party, you go to an event, you're going to meet, you know, an artist, you're going to meet someone in finance, you're going to meet a consultant, you're going to meet someone who's on Broadway, you're going to meet all kinds of people. In San Francisco, I go to a party, maybe I'm just going to the wrong parties, and everyone I meet is in tech. And I think there's a, you know, there are obviously some benefits to that, but just from a pure lifestyle perspective, I like it here. And, you know, generally, I think if you're starting a company, San Francisco is the best possible place you can be. It's the center of the universe for that. But I just made a lifestyle choice to live in New York.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. That's a beautiful place to close. So, Brad, thank you so much for taking the time. It was a fantastic chat. Definitely a pleasure.